Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Here in just a little bit, we'll have our guest for the evening, Mr. Paul Wright. He's the editor of Prison Legal News. But for now, this is a Drug Truth Network editorial. Please, please listen up. You know you can count on me to provide you with the unvarnished truth about the drug war. You also know that I will not, in fact, cannot do otherwise. To do otherwise, to speak untruths, to say things that are harmful to our society, to the individual, to the children, would have me immediately derided, demonized, vilified, and ostracized by the government agents who will not, in fact, cannot come on the Drug Truth Network program to explain the need for drug war. Nor can the media, the major corporate and complicit media, come out in favor of ending prohibition for fear their gathered billions would be examined and their complicity exposed, their truths found to be lacking. Though apparently they are now engaged in a slow, incremental shift towards the truth in that regard. The drug lords themselves, not the billionaires in Colombia and Afghanistan, for they are truly small players in this deceit. I speak of the bankers, the pharmaceutical, energy, alcohol, and tobacco companies, and their frenzied third horde of support drug warriors, to include prison builders, piss testers, treatment providers, and the vast majority of the medical community. On the bottom rung of the ladder are the worker bees of the drug war, to include assassins, traffickers, cops, judges, district attorneys, and other officials corrupted by the drug war billions. And lest we forget, snitches and street corner vendors. Sitting just under the ladder are all the rest of us, in the mud, under duress and great pressure. Once again, I say, you can count on me. I will provide you the unvarnished truth about the drug war, but this is where you, yes, you, God damn it, you must come in. I feel no impending doom, no oversight by the feds or the cartels, but I am intelligent enough to recognize the possibility that now, or any time in the near or distant future, it may come to pass, as it has for other journalists who dare venture into the twisted and evil cesspool of hypocrisy and ill-gotten $100 billion swindles. I am a legalizer, flat out, full tilt, take no prisoners, do it now. I offer a $1,200 reward to any drug warrior, police captain or above, any agent of the DEA, CIA, FBI, or Justice Department, any judge, any district attorney who is willing to spend 20 minutes with us over the airwaves explaining the need for drug war. Now, that's not a lot of money compared to the $550 billion we fork over each year to the list of drug lords I just referenced. But we have never had even one nibble. No response from Drug Czar John Walter's office, despite numerous requests, which gave six different ways we could discuss the subject of drug war. Their last response was to, quote, wish us well, end quote. I've contacted every government official in my chain of command, every major and minor media outlet, scientists, hospitals, and treatment centers. There is not one person of authority on planet Earth willing to defend this policy of eternal drug war. This inquisition, destined to last forever. I feel certain that given the enormity of this great and pervasive evil, that I have or will soon have enemies in this regard. But this is where you come in. I cover your ass, and I beg you to cover mine. Now, today, write the one-page letter, one-paragraph letter, maybe 50 words. What do you think of the drug war? What do you know of the drug war? Write it down. Send it to the local paper, to your congressman, state and local, to your mayor and police chief, the city council. I have a new webpage available to make it possible, endprohibition.org. 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 It's easy. With links to all kinds of ways to provide your Congress critters and other politicians your thoughts. We have links on better letter writing and much more. Why? For the children, yours and mine. For the future. For the present. For the common good. For God's sake. For the preservation of reality. But please, if for no other reason, I beg you, do it for me. If I am to be allowed to continue my work, it must blossom, nurtured by your letters to power, by your willingness to speak the truth in public, at soccer games, in PTA meetings, and soon, even within the workplace. Everywhere I go, I meet people who deeply appreciate the work I do. But all too often, I learn they have not yet written that 50 words, have not yet mailed it to those in authority, have not yet discussed the subject of drug prohibition, as they tell me they should. Meantime, I'm left wondering, what will it take to motivate? And now, our guest on Cultural Baggage, Mr. Paul Wright. This week I'm proud to have as our guest the editor of Prison Legal News, Mr. Paul Wright. I guess first off, tell us about your magazine and a little bit of your history as a journalist.
Prison Legal News is a monthly magazine that reports on all aspects of the criminal justice system, and we've been publishing since 1990, so in that sense we've seen the U.S. prison and jail system double in size while we've been publishing. Sample copies and more information about the magazine are available on our website at www.prisonlegalnews.org. We have subscribers throughout the U.S. prison system, and I founded the magazine in 1990 while I was imprisoned in Washington State, and we've been going strong ever since.
A couple of weeks back, I saw some stories there on that list talking once again about the numbers of prison rapes that occur in this nation each year. Tell us some stats on that, if you would.
Well, actual statistics are hard to find because until recently there had never been any concerted effort by government officials to compile the statistics on prison rape. And in fact, one of the big outrages that activist groups such as Prison Legal News and Stop Prisoner Rape, which is an organization dedicated to ending the sexual victimization of detainees, is the fact that the FBI and their criminal justice statistics do not count sexual assaults that occur in detention facilities in their annual rape statistics. So basically, if you want to know when a rape isn't a rape, well, when it happens behind bars, it isn't. And that's one of the things that has made this problem, you know, difficult to get a handle on. And it's the problem of rape behind bars. It's prevalent, it's widespread, and I think in a lot of respects, culturally, it's probably where the sexual assault of women was, say, 40 years ago, as far as being a taboo subject, there being a lot of stigma. The victims are afraid to come forward, both for fear of retaliation, not just by their assailants, but also by prison and jail officials, and also because of social stigmatization. And in most of the cases, what we're talking about here is these are a majority of the rapes that occur involving prisoners involve men being sexually assaulted by other men. And there's a lot of social taboos and a lot of social stigma to admit that. So I think this variety of factors has led to this being, you know, quite the silent epidemic. And it's something that the people with the biggest vested interest in ensuring that it continues, and by that I mean prison and jail officials, they have no incentive to stopping or halting or remedying the problem. Last year, President Bush signed a law into effect, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and its purpose is supposed to be to eliminate sexual assault behind bars, and I applaud the law because I think it's certainly a great first step in this area, but by the same token, it's a really small baby step. And one of the things that the law requires are that state prison systems and jails, as well as the federal prison system, start compiling statistics on the number of prisoners that are sexually assaulted while in custody. And kind of the problem with this is we've got a fox guarding the hen house syndrome. This is kind of typified by a case that's going on right now in Wichita Falls in Texas involving the case of Roderick Johnson. And Mr. Johnson was, in many respects, kind of a typical sexual assault victim in the sense that he was small in size, he was in prison for a nonviolent offense, and he was also gay. And his lawsuit centers around the fact that while he was in prison, he was sexually assaulted by other prisoners, and in numerous cases, he was basically sold into sexual slavery by prison gangs. And where basically anyone wishing to sexually assault Mr. Johnson could do so for a pack of cigarettes paid in tribute to one of the gangs that was basically holding him as a chattel slave. Mr. Johnson repeatedly sought protection from prison officials. Texas prison officials basically ignored his request for protection, basically giving him advice like, well, you need to stand up and fight like a man, or you need to get yourself a man, or basically, you know, you need to come to us with some bruises or some stab wounds or something before we'll take this seriously. I think that one of the key things here that people need to realize is that when people are placed in prison, the prisoner jail is responsible for their safety and their protection. Because by the act of incarceration, the state has deprived the person of the ability, of the legal ability to defend themselves. Prisoners aren't allowed to have weapons, they can't call the police, so it's a paramount duty for the state to provide the security and protection, and all too often, prison jail officials, not only do they fall down on the job, but they seem to ignore the fact that it's part of their job to do this. And when vulnerable prisoners like Mr. Johnson seek the aid and protection that they're entitled to under the Constitution of the United States, as well as a matter, I would think, of basic human decency, you know, they shrug it off, and people like Mr. Johnson are left to be sexually victimized. And how often this scenario plays out across the country every day is kind of open to anyone's guess. There are figures showing that Texas, for example, is in a recent study done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, shows that Texas has like the highest number of reported sexual assaults by prisoners, like something like 900. But I think that anyone that's familiar with the issue of prisons and jails thinks these numbers are very low and most likely underreported. It's one thing if you go through a prison sentence and you're 6'2" and weigh 200 pounds. It's another thing if you're 5'7" and weigh 150. And I'd never really thought of that since I'm the guy that's 6'2" and weighs 200 pounds.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is one of the things is that people... certain people in prison are more vulnerable to being victimized or sexually assaulted than others. And a lot of this is just common sense. And prison and jail officials, I would think that by virtue of their job experience, are aware of this, but they don't take that duty and that responsibility seriously. And there's also a thing, too, where in Mr. Johnson's case, because he was gay, prison officials basically laughed at his requests for protection by saying, well, you're gay, you must like being raped. And this is so outrageous that the analogous context would be if a heterosexual woman reports being raped to the police, and the police say, well, you're a heterosexual woman, you must like it. And that would nowhere be tolerated now on the outside world, but in prison, when sexual assault victims report being sexually assaulted repeatedly, they go to the prison and jail officials charged with their protection, and their pleas go unanswered, and that's basically the response that they get. When basically the issue of prison rape is something that late-night comics can tell jokes about on TV and get away with it, whereas I think today no one would think about making jokes or banter about the sexual assault of women. And that's why I say that I think that the sexual assault of prisoners is culturally and socially where the sexual assault of women was, say, 40 years ago.
prison officials don't want your magazine coming into their prisons, but you've developed a bit more clout in this response. Tell us about the recent settlement you had.
Prison Legal News has been faced with a bit of hostility from prison officials around the country over the years, basically because we tell prisoners what their rights are, how to go about using the court system to enforce those rights. And so we've been censored on basically a variety of pretty specious grounds. Just last month, we settled a lawsuit against the Washington Department of Corrections, where since 2001, they had been censoring our renewal letters to our Washington prisoner subscribers. They had been censoring mail on the basis that we send it to prisoners, and also because we would send prisoners court rulings. And this includes rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court that would be of interest to prisoners. Prison Legal News, we won most of our claims. We won our claims on the censorship of our bulk mail. We won the censorship of our catalogs and our renewal letters. And a court also held that we're entitled to be told when our mail is being censored. In other words, the Washington DOC's practice of just throwing away our mail in the garbage without telling us was found to be unconstitutional. Judge Lasnik, a federal judge in Seattle, entered injunctions ordering that the DOC stop doing those things. And with regards to our claim on the censorship of court rulings, that claim was set for trial. And shortly before trial, the Washington DOC settled the case. All told, they wound up paying in attorney's fees and damages $445,000, which we're pretty sure is at this point the largest settlement or verdict in a prison censorship case in American history.
That should serve as a lesson to other prison wardens, I suppose, to think twice before stopping free speech here in America. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to think that, but unfortunately, in this case, in the Washington case, this was the fourth time we had successfully sued them over censoring our bulk mail. And I think part of the problem here is that the Washington taxpayers have paid out $445,000, but none of the prison officials, some of whom we've sued several times and won on this exact same issue, aren't paying a dime. And part of the problem here is there's no accountability within the prisoner jail system when they don't do their jobs or when they screw up their jobs. And I think this is a case where taxpayers are the ones stuck with the bill, and the people that do illegal things that are found to violate the law basically are free to keep doing it. And I think that's one of the larger problems about prisons and jails in this country as a system, is that the people running them and working in them have very little, first, they have very little scrutiny over their actions, and then when you combine that with the fact that there's very little accountability, so that even when they are found to have broken the law or engaged in many cases, egregious misconduct, you know, they keep their jobs, they keep drawing their salaries, and they usually get promoted. One lawsuit we have against the Florida Department of Corrections, they were censoring our magazine based on our advertising content. And all told, they changed their policy six times, and they say they'll let the magazine in, and no problem. But the man who heads the Florida prison system is a man named James Crosby. He was the warden of the Florida State Prison in Stark when a death row prisoner named Frank Valdez was beaten to death by prison guards. And he wasn't just beaten to death as in he got beat up a little bit and accidentally died. He was beaten to death in the sense that every one of his ribs was crushed, his testicles were crushed, and he had boot imprints on his face. The guards who administered the beating were charged and tried in Florida State Court in front of a jury composed almost entirely of prison employees or people related to prison employees in this rural county in North Florida, and they were acquitted of murder charges. But the warden, Mr. Crosby, who was running the prison at the time, he has since been promoted to run the whole prison system. I guess this comes down to the whole thing of, you know, where's the responsibility and where's the accountability in our prisons and jails, and I think that's a large part of the problem.
Well, we've been speaking with Paul Wright, the editor of Prison Legal News. Paul, a closing thought here. We send 1.6 million U.S. citizens to holding cells, to detention centers, and to prisons each year for drug possession. If we could get rid of that number, would it not cut back on the overcrowding and hopefully eliminate some of the other problems within our prison system?
Yes, it would, and that's why Prison Legal News, like I think every other prisoner rights or prisoner advocacy organization in this country, supports sentencing reform, because while the crime rate is officially low or falling, and that the prison population around this country continues to grow exponentially, and what's driving that is the failed war on drugs, where more and more people are being sent to prison for drug offenses, and this is something, for what it's worth, the FBI doesn't include drug offenses in their crime rate reports. So in other words, when you read that crime rates are falling, the only crimes that are counted in official crime rates are crimes against people. And this includes armed robbery, murder, rape, car theft, and there's something else. Basically, there are seven crimes against people that form the crime indexes. But drug crimes are not on there. And this is one of those things where people ask themselves, well, gee, how can the prison population keep growing if the crime rate is falling? And in reality, there's no correlation between the two. That's one of the things that people need to realize, is that what's driving the massive prison expansion in this country is the war on drugs. And the illegality of drugs is something that I think envelops the whole of the criminal justice system. And it's not just the people that are actually sent to prison for drug possession or drug distribution, but a majority of the people that are in prison, regardless of what they were actually convicted of, I would say, based on my personal observations, I would say probably 90% of the people in prison, their criminal activity or their criminal conviction stems directly or indirectly from the fact that drug use is treated as a criminal problem for poor people in this country, and it's not addressed as a public health problem. While people may go to prison for armed robbery, all too often the people were committing armed robberies to support their drug habits. And that's the type of thing that I think has to be looked at in a bigger picture, that until America gets serious about addressing its drug policy, I think that we're going to wind up with an ever-increasing and ever-expanding prison and jail population.
All right. And one last time, your website, Paul.
The website for Prison Legal News is www.prisonlegalnews.org. We have sample copies, subscription information, and a bookstore, and a whole bunch of other stuff on there. So check it out if you're interested in criminal justice issues.
As mentioned in the editorial, and as regular listeners are aware, we offer cash money to drug warriors willing to come on the show. But because they're unwilling to do so, we build a little report for them each week, because they are truly such cowards.
Listen up. The vast majority of American people want more drug war. The vast majority. Not even drug legalization advocates contend otherwise. It is an irrefutable fact that those who speak out against drug prohibition are a small minority. Drug legalization advocates would have you believe that there is a silent majority that long for an end to drug war but fail to take a stand. Of course, this is nonsense, but let's pretend for one second that this absurd fantasy has anything to do with reality. Exactly what do we expect the government to do with this information? Legislate based on the assumed opinion of the silent majority? Please. The government can do no such thing. The government is obligated to act on the voice of the majority, the one calling for more drug war. And the silent majority? There is no silent majority. How could there be? Tens of millions of Americans twiddling their thumbs, longing for an end to drug war, possessing the power to change things and opting not to use it? I don't buy it. Isn't it more likely that the vast majority of Americans realize the dangers involved in drug legalization and want the drug war? You bet your ass it is. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
Don't go playing the blame game. There's no time for delay. Don't go playing the blame game. Look away. Look away.
Former drug czar William Bennett had touched off a firestorm recently by apparently blaming African Americans for crime in the U.S. What is the reality of crime in America? Here are the numbers. According to the Justice Department, in 2003, victims reported that the offender was white in 63% of single-offender violent victimizations and black in 21%. For a majority of crimes in which an offender can be identified, the offender and victim are the same race. Of course, only 48% of all violent crimes and 38% of all property crimes that year were ever reported to the police, according to the Justice Department. Of all demographic groups, black women were the most likely to report violent crime, black men the most likely to report property crime. To an extent, this reality is reflected in arrest statistics. The FBI reports that in 2003, 60.5% of violent crime arrests were of whites, 37% of blacks. For property crimes, it's 68% white, 29% black. Bennett's remarks, uninformed by any facts, reflected his long-held opinion that young people and the economically disadvantaged are to blame for society's ills. That was the premise of Body Count, the 1996 book he co-authored along with John DiIulio and our current drug czar, John Walters. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
America sleeps well knowing that the drug war protects their children from drugs.
Children have easier access to drugs than alcohol or tobacco.
Politicians work hard, spending ever more money to crush the black market.
Each year we give $500 billion to terrorist cartels and criminals to buy bigger weapons to kill us.
Is there a hit of speed big enough to wake up America? Wake the hell up. Learn the truth about the drug war at Common Sense for Drug Policy, CSDP.org.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Responsible for countless overdose deaths, uncounted diseases, international graft, greed, and corruption, stilted science, and immense unchristian moral postulations of fiction as fact. Time's up. And this drug is the United States' immoral, improper, bigoted, unscientific, and plain effing evil addiction to drug war. All approved by the FDA, absolved by the American Medical Association, and persecuted by Congress, the cops, and in obeyance to the needs of the bankers, the pharmaceutical houses, and the international drug cartels. $550 billion a year can be very addicting. Once again, I want to remind you that if you are sponsoring an event in your city and you'd like to have me come visit, give a speech, I'd be glad to do it. There is no cost involved. Help me with some expenses. I'll be there. It's easy to get in touch with me. Just email dean@drugtruth.net. Drug Truth is universal. Some of the programmers I talk to in some of the smaller stations tell me that they don't know that their audience is ready for the Drug Truth Network, yet there has never been one objection to our programs. Our latest station, by the way, KASF in Alamosa, Colorado, I'm glad you guys have joined up with us. Welcome to the Drug Truth Network. Please visit our new website. It's very important. EndProhibition.org. I want you to help. I need you there, please. So to all you folks out there who've gotten the message, make sure that those in power get it as well. I'd appreciate your help. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of cannabis.